We are at the very beginning of Elul, and we are trying to get into the mood of what is ahead of us. This the month of Elul, according to all of the Sfarim HaKadoshim, is a very special time, a very opportune time. It's at once, it's the conclusion of the year that was, and it's the preparation for the beginning of the year which is to be. And the Sfarim HaKadoshim point out all kinds of insights which the very name of the month itself invites us to consider, such as Ani Ledodi Vedodi Li, I am to my beloved, my beloved is to me. That's that phrase, the first letter of each word in that phrase, when put together, spells out the word Elul. Another well-known one is the pasuk Umol Hashem Rekecho Es Levavcho Ves Levav Zarecho. And the Almighty will circumcise your heart and the hearts of your children, meaning that when our hearts are closed and we are unable to feel, that the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Master of the World, will remove the barrier between our being able to feel and Himself. And once again, Es Levavcha the Es Levav, in that pasuk spells out, the first letters of each word spell out the word Elul. So it's a time, Elul, it becomes a time in which we understand that there's a certain reciprocity between ourselves and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Whatever we do, that's how the Almighty will respond. And secondly, that it is a time in which we are to somehow try to break the barriers and the crust and the calluses which render us unfeeling. Historically, Elul marks the time when Moshe Rabbeinu ascended to the mountain for the third portion, the third 40-day period, from the time that he first went up to the mountain, the first 40 days, when Hashem taught him the entire Torah, when he gave him the first tablets of stone, at the conclusion of which Moshe Rabbeinu descended, found that Klal Yisrael were in the process of worshipping the Egel Hazav, the golden calf, and then he destroyed the first tablets. He went up again on the following day. The day in which he came down was in which he broke the luchos was Shivasa V'Tamiz, which has subsequently become one of the very tragic days in Jewish history. And he went up the following day on the 18th day of Tammuz. He remained there until the last day of Av. During that period of 40 days, the Almighty, the Almighty prayed that Hashem Yisbarach would not destroy Klal Yisrael, that he might forgive them. He was really only partially successful. Rosh Chodesh Elul, he went up again, ascended to the mountain, and remained there for 40 days. That 40-day period concluded with Yom Kippur. It was on Yom Kippur that Hashem said, Salachti ki dvarecha, I will forgive them, I forgive them, as it were, with a full heart. And he gave him the second tablets of stone, which Moshe Rabbeinu brought down on the 10th day of Tishrei. So that's how those three 40-day periods go. And the Torah brings in Shulchan Aruch that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up the third time for the last 40 days, that they sounded the shofar so that everybody would mark precisely when he went up, so that when they would make their calculations about when the 40 days were to conclude, that they wouldn't get confused as they had the first time, and which really led up to the Chet HaEgel. And we, because of the fact that in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, they sounded the shofar when Moshe went up to the beginning of Elul, so we sound the shofar every day. Given this historical picture and its connection to the Yamim Tovim, the Yamim Neiraim, the days of awe, traditionally speaking, the days of Elul are days of introspection, days in which we take inventory about the good things and the not such good things, our successes, our failures, the things that we are more than just a little bit imperfect on. We try to engage in tshuva and being penitent. We try to plan for the future so that we meet Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur having done our homework. But I would like to try to develop for you over here some sense of how we can do this effectively. In the Sefer Yetzirah, in the Book of Creation, which I know relatively little about, but about which I can repeat some words and some sentences, there is a statement which reads as follows. Himlich Eis Yud B'maisa, the Almighty coronated the letter Yud upon action. Letter Yud, he conferred, he coronated upon deeds, acts. The Elul B'Shana, and he introduced Elul into the calendar. V'yatzmil B'Nefesh, and in the configuration of things, the left arm in the soul. I'd like to work with that as a point of departure and to take yet another point of reference from the Zohar. The Tikkuni Zohar says, and my great-grandfather in his work, Pele Yoyet, makes reference to this Tikkuni Zohar frequently, that the name of Hashem, God's name, the ineffable name, the one that we find spelled in our Sidurim or in the Chumashim, Yud, Ke, Vav, Ke. We don't pronounce it that way. We pronounce it meaning Master, Adni. That we find that reflected in the way in which a person davens, the way in which a person is mispallel, the way in which a person prays. And that what happens is as follows. The letter Yud is the letter of the mind, the letter of thought, the letter of wisdom. As a direct product of thought, when a person considers the majesty of the Almighty and considers his own humble gifts, there is something which responds within us emotionally. In other words, we are struck with the awe of the majesty of the infinite Creator. We are struck by our own mortal limitations, and that juxtaposition fills us with some very heavy kinds of emotional sensations. We feel a sense of dread, a sense of awe, a sense of fear, a sense of yearning, a sense of love. All kinds of things happen. The letter, the second letter of the divine name, the letter He, is the letter of the heart. In other words, it begins with the letter Yud of the mind, which reflects thought and wisdom, and that provokes the He, which represents the emotion of the heart. That in turn mandates that the person do something. when a person is overcome, you see a magnificent sunrise. You turn around, and all of a sudden you see this absolutely sensational horizon. And you go, there's something that happens. You can't bottle up a very powerful emotion. So there's something that has to happen. So there is the next level of response is in sound, which is called kail, not with a chaf, but with a kuf, kail. And that letter, that kail is represented by the letter vav in the divine name. And finally, if we can actually shape some words to communicate something of what is happening to us, so we have, once again, the final hey of the divine name that represents what takes place in our mouth. Hey bepeh. The hey is in the mouth, and as you know, there are five sounds that we shape with our when we speak. There are five hey, there hey meitzoi sapeh, the hey, the five sounds which shape all the words that we use. So the divine name becomes symbolized by this progression. We begin by the consideration, in a certain sense intellectually, the awe is awakened in our hearts, or the emotions are thus provoked, and we now add the letter hey. That in turn evokes a sound, a kail, and finally it ends up in the words which try to give some intelligible shape and form to what we are experiencing. To some extent, if we looked at this season that we're in, we would find that same progression. The period of Elo is a period in which the letters Yud, the first two letters, the Yud and the He, are the predominant theme. It's a time in which we are doing a great deal of thinking about the Almighty and ourselves and our relationship. And there is all kinds of emotions which are building as a result. Emotions of remorse, emotions of resolve, emotions of commitment, emotions of love, emotions of awe. That then leads, after the Yud and the He are accounted for in the month of Elul, that leads to the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, in which the holiday of Rosh Hashanah revolves around the concept of Kail, which is the sounding of the shofar. The sounding of the shofar is in Koid. There are no words to it. It's nothing more than the soul crying out. It's the soul giving some voice to what it is experiencing. And finally, we reach Yom Kippur, in which we begin now to shape these emotions into words. And that's why we have all of these things that are associated with words, called Nidre, which is deals with the way in which our emotions found their way into promises and oaths. The mitzvah of Vidui, which is a verbal mitzvah. So that's really the paradigm of this season. Is this that throughout Elul and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we are really forming the divine name, the Yud and the Hey, during the month of Elul, and the Kol and the Dibur, the Vav and the Hey, during Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Now these two letters, which make up the essence of the month of Elul, are a team. They are reflected in many interesting ways. For example, one of the more familiar ways is in husband and wife, in Ish and Isha. Ish and Isha are both spelled alike. Ish has an aleph and a shin, and Isha has an aleph and a shin. The difference between them is that the Ish has a yud, and Isha has a hey. And together, they form a single unit. If we look at this once again, the role or the function of the male is a more intellectual function, whereas the role of the female is one which really translates that ideological position, that intellectual or philosophical position, into functioning feelings, emotions. It translates them into something which is an operative part of their lives. One might also call that the progression from Chachma, which is the Yud, to the Hey, which represents Bina, an understanding. And the women, as you well know, were endowed by the Almighty with an extra measure of Bina. It's also interesting where these letters appear. In the male, the Yud comes between the Aleph and the Shin, because intellect is cold. So the intellect, the Yud, the Chachma, really comes in between the Aleph and the Shin. Whereas in women, where this is actually transformed into living, operating tissue, where this is a something which is now an actual feeling, it comes after the word Esh, because there is an Esh here. There is a passion here. The woman is functioning on something which is part of the real world. And therefore, the letter Hey does not come in between the Aleph and the Shin, but rather after it, because there is an ongoing passion. So we have these two worlds. We have the ideological, and we have the practical world. And together they create the name of Hashem. Together they form a living ethic. When I say living ethic, that's manifest, for example, in the Chumash. In the Chumash, there is one point in the Chumash where there is a census. And there's a census. And the text refers to all the different families in the tribes. And it does so in a very peculiar and unique way. It's in Pinchas, first Pinchas. The children of Reuven. So there's Chanoich, Mishpachas HaChanoichi, Lefalu, Mishpachas HaPalui, Lechetzron, Mishpachas HaChetzronid. By Shimon Nimuel is Mishpachas HaNimueli. So Rashi says, what's going on here? So Rashi says that the world, when the world saw that Israel was doing a census, and that the census had been ordered according to trace one's ancestry to the family of the father, so the world mocked Israel as though to say, who are you kidding? They lived in Egypt. And Egypt, if Egypt held them in slavery, then there's no question about the fact that they took advantage of their women. So there is no yichus here, because they really could not trace their ancestry to their husbands. So Hashem comes along and says, I testify that they were faithful to their husbands. And my testimony is by my placing my name besides each one of theirs. So, for example, Chanoch, it's HaChanochi. There's a Hey at the beginning and a Yud at the end. That forms God's name. The Yud and the Hey are God's name. So Hashem says, I place my name besides each family to testify by the presence of my name that they were faithful to their husbands, and that these children are in fact children of their parents. And our sages quote the pasuk Shivteka Edus LiYisrael, the tribes of God, a testimony to Israel. So he says Shivteka, he uses this name of God, Yud K. It's the Yud K which testifies to the purity of the ancestry of Kol Yisrael. How does this happen? Why Yud K? Why the Yud and the Hey are a testimony? The point is that when the ideological and the practical come together, that tells us that the goals of a nation and their conduct are in fact consistent with one another, and that that therefore the discipline which guides their lives is such that their family lives were conducted with the utmost purity, and that they did not submit themselves to the blandishments of Egyptian power. Moreover, in the beginning of Bereshis, we have the pasuk Eile Seildeis Hashemayim V'Ha'oretz V'Hiboram. These are the stories. This is the unfolding. This is the history of the world, of heaven and earth, as they were created. The word Behibaram, in the word Behibaram, if you look in the Sefer Torah, in the scroll, the letter He is a small letter. And our sages address this by saying Behibaram. In other words, you could read the word Behibaram in their creation, or Behibaram, that the world, heaven and earth, were created with the letter He. And our sages once again comment over here that this world, Olam Hazeh, came into being with the letter He. That Olam Haba came into being with the letter Yud. In other words, the goal, the ideological premise for creation is represented by this letter Yud. That's the Chochmah. That's the thought, that's the philosophy of the world. But it is the letter He which brought the world into being. And it is the letter He, because it has reference to a practical world, which in its shape tells you something about this practical world. What is that message? Our sages tell us, and Rashi quotes it in Bereshis. The message is that the letter He is open at the bottom. For those who choose to live a wicked life, a wicked existence, they will descend into the abyss. They will destroy their lives in such a way that they will fall into the abyss. But if they should seek to make their way back, the letter He has a little opening on the left side, up on top. There's like a door, and you can reclaim, and you can reestablish your integrity. The letter He, therefore, represents the concept of tshuva, a concept which is only meaningful in this world of practicality. It has no relevance at all in the world of God's wisdom, because in that theoretical world, in the world of God's thought, there is no sin. So once again, we have this concept of the He as being the letter which which makes reference to the actual world, to the world of passion, to the world of confusion. We know that the He is the fifth letter of the alphabet and is numerically five, and that this world in which we operate, is a world in which we function through five senses. We conduct our lives by everything which is transmitted to us through the senses of sight and hearing and touching, smelling, and tasting. Those are the five senses. And we know that the world which we manipulate with our hands, each of which has five fingers. Once again, a reference to the fact that the world of action, the world of interaction between ourselves and the world is represented by the He. The He also represents, in Hebrew, something that allows us to identify something particular, so that if you wanted to say this thing, the object, the door, whatever, you would use the He Hayidia. You would say HaSefer, the Sefer. That would pick out a particular article. It also communicates direction, He. Because if you wanted to say LeMitzrayim, to Egypt, you could remove the lamed at the beginning, which represents to, gives you the sense of direction, and instead replace it with a hey at the end, and that would tell you Mitzrayim up, to Mitzrayim. The hey is again a very practical letter. It's a letter that identifies definite articles, it's a letter that identifies direction, and it's a letter which also asks a question. Halashem tigmluzeis, ha'im, is it so? These are things which all have reference to our practical world. But this now creates a little bit of a problem for us. Because we identified earlier in the Tikkuni Zohar two different heys. There was a hey which follows sound, which succeeds sound, the hey of the mouth, which represents the articulation of something that we superimpose upon the sound. Here we are, we just saw the sunset. We go, ah, and that's just the sound. But when we add something to it and we begin to use our tongue and lips and palate and teeth and whatever to shape things, we can say words. What a beautiful sunset. What a magnificent horizon. We can now discipline that sound. That is a sound. That's a hay with words. But the hay which appears in the heart is one without words. And how do we think without words? So here we come to somewhat of an impasse. We recognize that something begins in the world of thought, in the world of theory, in the world of planning, in the world of intellect. And that in turn provokes something in the heart. And that which it provokes in the heart is very passionate, has all kinds of feelings and emotions associated with it, large and small. And for the most part, most of us are emotionally constricted. One of the hallmarks of great people was their capacity to move into feeling in a very genuine and in a very natural way. Their joy was full, it was robust, it was contagious, it was transparent. Their yearning was transparent. When they stood before their Creator, you saw someone who was in a position of, in a status of fear and trembling. They were awestruck. They were standing in God's presence. There was no mistake about where they were at that moment. They had been transported into a different realm. And everything about them showed it. The Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov recorded that in numerous instances when the Baal Shem Tov davened, that everything around him trembled. Not only he trembled, but everything around him trembled. That there would be some distance away a barrel of water, and that the water trembled, because there was something of such magnitude taking place. So most of us really feel sort of cheated, because we come into a relationship with the Almighty, and we would like to feel love, and we would like to feel longing, but we don't. We would like to feel that sense of fear and trembling, but we don't. We think it, but we don't feel it. We would like to feel remorse, but we don't. We would like to feel joy and gratitude, but we don't. Not in terms of feeling, because what's happening is that we're thinking the words. We are thinking the words, the Almighty is so generous to me. He is so charitable to me. He has overlooked my wrongdoing. He's been so patient with me. I should love him. I say the words, I love him. But there's no feeling that goes along with it. I say the words, the Almighty is infinite. He is all-powerful. He is the author of every moment in time of my life. And I should feel a tremendous sense of awe. And I say, I fear God. But I don't. I say the words. And I know what the words mean. But the feelings aren't there. I say, I regret having done that. But the kind of searing pain, kind of torment which people once felt. It's amazing what the kinds of the range of feelings amongst great people, how authentic they were. Just read today, there was this book, A Tzaddik in Our Time, by Levine. It's a wonderful, very, very remarkable biography. Rabbi Levine was a Talmid in his youth in Slutsk, in Slobodka, I think, by Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. I'm not real great on my geography and exactly where they were. I once did, but once again, my old age is creeping up on me. So, later on, when Rabbi Zalman went there to Israel and he became Rosh Hashiva in Eitz Chaim, and at this point already Rabbi Levine was already a personality in his own right, he would frequently go over on a pretty regular basis. He would go over to spend some time with his Rosh Hashiva, with Rabbi Zalman. And they would, on occasion, they would remind one another of things that took place in the old days. So on one occasion, Rabbi Levine was reminiscing about the different people in the community. And in those days, they didn't have a cafeteria where the students ate. Instead, they had an institution called Teg. Teg is the Yiddish word meaning days. And every day they would have designated a certain balabais, a certain home that they would go to for lunch or for supper, and they would get a meal. So each student had a list of his Teg people. So Rav Isser Zalman said to Rabbaye, he said to him, where did you eat Teg? So he said, well, I used to eat Teg by so-and-so, and they reminded themselves about so-and-so, and then he said, and I used to eat Teg another day, on Tuesday, ate by so-and-so, this other balabos, and then Wednesday, so-and-so. Anyway, so Rav Isser Zalman says, after they were talking for a while, he says, then wait a minute. He says, I counted 4 days. What happened? Who were the balabatim the other 3 days? Where were the homes that you went to? Rabbi Levin said to him, nobody ever assigned me the other 3 days, so 3 days a week I didn't eat. So this is Zalman said to him, what? 3 days a week you didn't eat, and you didn't come and tell me about it? So he says, Rebbe, he said to him, those are the three best days of my I learned better those days, and there was more mysterious nefesh those days. And anyway, this was on a Friday night, and he went home. Middle of the night, there's a knock on the door, and it's the Rebbitzin. So she says to him, Aryeh, you must come back with me. The Rosh Hashiva has been absolutely beside himself. He's walking around and in a storm. And he has no peace. You must come back and you've got to resolve this. So Abaye gets dressed, goes back. It's in the middle of the night, goes back. And the Rosh Hashiva is pacing the floor. Rabbi walks in and he's weeping. He says to him, there was a student of mine, he says, and I didn't know it. And he says, in 3 days every week you didn't eat. And it was like tearing his hair out. And this Rabbi starts jumping up and down, but Rabbi, it was my fault and it's not your fault, and I could have gone up to somebody in the yeshiva. It took him all night just to calm him down. Because of the fact, and it wasn't Rav Isser Zalman's fault. I had to come up and just said 2 words. People lived, there were and are people who are so authentic that it just doesn't like take place at a intellectual level. Gee, that's terrible. It takes place at 11 where there's real passion, where there's real feeling, where people are tormented, where they're the principles of their lives are directly related to what they feel and how they respond. So given that the fact that there are some people who manage to live in that way, seems to me that we must identify and discriminate between, we have to distinguish between two different kinds of thinking. One which is kind of an audio and verbal form, and the other one which is visual and conceptual. The verbal form is colorless. It has no personality and there's no passion. And when we engage in that kind of thinking, when we're asking questions and answering. If we're going to spend Elo saying to ourselves, okay, now what did I do wrong? Or how could I do better? And we're going to have this dialogue inside of our heads and we'll answer. There's not going to be any feeling associated with it. There won't be the depth of remorse that we should have. There won't be the depth of resolve that we should have. there won't be the connection that we look for in our trying to relate to the Almighty. It's not going to happen because we're talking through words. And the kinds of words which make up feelings are not the words that we find in our mouths, but the kinds of words which we find in our heart before there is a sound attached to them. And those kinds of words are not words, they're pictures. These are not sentences that are made up out of letters. These are visual images. What we need to do is to recognize that if Elul is going to be successful for us, it's only going to be successful to the extent that we will effectively create the kinds of images that will bring some genuine passion into our lives. It's a Gemara in Brachas. Gemara reads as follows. Hani chamisha borchi nafshi. There are three kapitlach in Tehillim that begin with borchi nafshi. My soul is mevorech. My soul... Yeah. Five, what did I say? Oh, I'm sorry. Five. Chamisha. There are five Borchi Nafshis. So the Gemara says, Keneged mi Amron David. About whom, or about what, did King David sing these five Borchi Nafshis? My soul blesses. Lo yamoran ela keneged HaKadosh Baruch Hu keneged Neshama. The Gemara says that King David recited these, he sang these, with reference to the Almighty and with reference to the soul. Ma HaKadosh Baruch Hu Molei Kol Olam, just as the Almighty fills the world, the entirety of the universe, Af Neshama Moleios Kol HaGuf, so also does the Neshama fill the entirety of one's body. Ma HaKadosh Baruch Hu Zonis Kol Olam Kulai, just as the Almighty sustains, he feeds the entire world, Af Neshama Zonas Kol HaGuf, so also does the soul sustain and nurture the entire body. Ma HaKadosh Baruch Hu Tahor, just as Hashem is Tahor, he's pure, Af Neshama Tahor, so also is the Neshama Tahor. Ma HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yeshiv V'Chadrei Hadorim, just as the Almighty dwells in the innermost precincts, Af Neshama Yeshev B'Chadrei Chadorim. So also does the soul occupy the innermost precincts. Yavei Mi Sheyesh B'Chamisha Dvarim Halalu. Therefore, let a human being who has these five qualities come, V'Yeshabeach L'Mi Sheyesh B'Chamisha Dvarim Halalu, and praise he who has these five characteristics. I would like to suggest that these five Borchi Nafshis represent five dimensions which in the hay of our world, in this world which is dominated by the acts and the feelings that revolve around the axis of five, comprise five basic questions which we need to consider. First question that we ought to consider, and again, bear in mind that we need to consider these questions visually. In other words, we need to make some time. We need to set aside, not a lot, but a small amount of time, when we can have the luxury of thinking in some context of quiet and solitude. And during that period of time, we need to visualize the fact that we are standing before the Almighty, whom we can't see. But we are in His throne room, Kaviyochel. Cannot see Him, but we know that we stand in His infinite presence, and what we do here inside of us is Him asking us a question. The first question that He's going to ask us, that we need to consider during the month of Elul, is the question of faith. Do you really, honestly believe in me? That's the question that we must hear Him asking us. Now, we have to understand what that question means. That question means, how well do you know me? How much do you know about my attributes? How familiar are you with the way in which I relate to the world? It's a very comprehensive question. It's not like, oh, I believe in you. Hashem. Because faith has a very exhaustive amount of knowledge that goes into it. And our faith is directly proportionate to how much we know about Hashem and how He interacts with the world. And we must also understand that these questions have two sides to them. The positive and the negative. So when the question is asked, how well, it also reads, how little. Second question is, question that revolves around the topic of bitachin and trust. Do you know how intimately I am involved in your life? How everything that happens to you is custom tailored and orchestrated by my hand? Do you understand that? Do you live it? Do you feel it? And the question is a question which we must be able to respond to with the knowledge of how we act. In the first Siman of Shulchan Aruch, when it talks about this concept, it says that somebody who knows that they are standing and sitting in God's presence reflects that. You never get angry in God's presence. You don't lose your temper in God's presence. It's just when you're in the court, the king, would you lose your temper? If you lose your temper, if you were standing in the presence of a total stranger, would you lose your temper if you were in the mayor's office? You just all of a sudden get blow up and then use a couple of well-chosen expletives deleted? Would we do that kind of thing? Would we carry on? Would the tone of our voice be raised? Would the sharpness of our expressions be what they are? If we really felt that the Almighty every moment was overseeing and supervising what we were doing? Would we eat the way we sometimes eat? Third question is, are you fulfilling my rotzen? Are you fulfilling my will? Are you doing my mitzvahs? Are you avoiding the things that you're supposed to avoid with the measure of zehirus, the measure of caution that you're supposed to? Are you playing a dangerous game? Are you gambling? Is this brinkmanship? Are you taking the Torah lightly? To what extent? How thoroughly do you do a mitzvah? How much do you put yourself out on a mitzvah? What is the level of our indolence? What is the level of our ignorance? Fourth question is, what about in things that are not directly related to mitzvahs? The rest of our lives. Supposedly the commonplace things of our lives that don't take place under the scope of mitzvahs. Every part of everything else that we do, the way in which we interact with our families, the way in which we interact with our friends, what happens at the office, all the things in life. Or the concept of v'chol drachach do'eu. Do we in fact suffuse the entirety of our lives with a God consciousness? So that if there's something which belongs to the service of the Almighty, then we do it, and we do it enthusiastically. But if we can't figure out how something belongs to the, or is directly connected to the service of the Almighty, then we walk away from it. It's just not pertinent to our lives. It's not germane, because we can't fill that activity that's under consideration with spirituality. We can't confer upon it a God consciousness. And finally, fifth question is, how am I dealing with trials and tribulations? How am I dealing with those times when God hides his face from me? How do I deal with those times when things that are important to me don't work out? How do I deal with failure? Do I respond with despair? Am I bitter against God? Am I angry at God? These five, I believe, have to do with, or have reference to, the Borchi Nafshis, the five different expressions of King David when he sought to look at the communality between the soul of man and God. There's one concept which is, just as God is tahor, so is the soul of man tahor. Which is to say that if we understand the purity, the absolute purity of God's being, we can't understand it obviously in its infinitude, but to the extent that we appreciate the tahara of the Almighty, so also will we be suffused with the feelings that are a product of and that will lead us to the tahara of our own, the integrity of our soul. So there is that question that deals with the issue of faith and that flows directly from God's perfect being. God sees but is never seen. Meaning that the Almighty is a mashgiach on our lives. We don't see him, but he is there and present every moment of our lives, from the times that we stand in the synagogue at Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur to what happens when we are alone in the bathroom. The Almighty's presence is always there. And we need to deal with the question of Hashem is a raya ve'enei nira. Can I therefore also be someone who sees and who understands and appreciates that presence? And conducts my life accordingly. The Almighty is Zan Es Ha'olam. He sustains the world. He nurtures the world. And one question that relates to the way in which God nurtures the world is, am I eating what God is serving? In other words, am I a Shomer Torah Mitzvahs? Do I observe God's commandments? Am I Zan? Am I Mefarnes? Do I sustain? Do I feed? Do I nourish my soul? The Almighty is Memale Es Kol Olam. The Almighty fills the entire world. Not only the synagogue, not only the Holy of Holies, but he fills the parks, he fills the office spaces, he fills our bedrooms, It fills the entire world. And we need to ask ourselves a question about whether or not, in the way in which our souls conduct themselves, whether we are mindful of the fact that the Almighty's presence extends to all activities. And finally, God Himself is Bechadrei Chadorim. There are many times that God hides in the innermost precincts, times in which we fail, times in which we suffer. And we don't see where God is, because He is Bechadrei Chadorim. He is in a room, inside of a room. He's in concealment. And we need to know whether or not, when God is Bechadrei Chadorim, whether we are still attached to Him. Now, if we can engage in this visual exercise and recognize that we stand stripped and exposed before the Almighty, there is no posturing here. There's no charades. The Almighty operates on absolute truth. We stand in front of the Almighty, and here we are, and we envision mushrooming up within us the sound of the Almighty saying to us, "How well do you know me? What have you done to know me better? What have you learned to make you more knowledgeable about my ways?" What will be our response? And if you're doing this well, if this visual exercise, if this imaging is taking place as it should, there will be feelings, not words, there will be feelings. Feelings of embarrassment. Feelings of remorse about the way in which we invest our time. Feelings of commitment about the fact that we're going to do something so that we can answer that question more effectively the next time it comes around. And when we stand before Him on Rosh Hashanah, that there will already be some sort of a program in place. And similarly, with each one of these questions, if we will deal with them visually, if we will deal with them conceptually, rather than say to ourselves, "Okay, how well do I know God?" Well, no, there's nothing. Nothing's happening. And Elul is supposed to be a time in which the Yud connects up with the hay, in which the mind connects up with the heart. So if we want to break through this crust, if Elul is to be Umol Hashem Elokecha Slevavcha Veslevav Zarecha, if Elul is to be this time in which we are able to circumcise that barrier and excise it from our hearts, then it will very much depend upon an exercise which precedes words. Because what we need to deal with over here is not Yom Kippur, nor even yet Rosh Hashanah, but we are involved in the exercise of trying to see things as they are in fact taking place, and trying to perceive how it is that we would respond in this situation. Sefer Yetzirah therefore tells us, Himlich Ois Yud B'maisa, that the Almighty crowned the letter Yud upon Maisa, upon deeds, which is to say that the Almighty brought together the world of wisdom and thought and enabled thought to provoke something actual in this world of deeds, emotions and feelings and passion and dread and love and longing and commitment. The Elul B'Shana, and the month of Elul in the year, so that during the month of Elul there is this direct connection between the letter Yud, representing thought and wisdom and intellect, and the world of deed, which we need desperately to try to plug into. Yad Smel B'Nefesh, and the left arm in the soul, which is to say that when these kinds of things are happening, then we recognize that the way in which we act upon this world is not by dint of our own might, because the left hand is the weaker of the two hands, but rather by virtue of the fact that we are connected to the Almighty. So the Yad Smail represents the more passive of the hands, and one which does not allow us to entertain the illusion that we are in control, or which by extension has greater reference to this world of words, which is devoid of feeling, because it is the left arm which is closest to the heart. And it is the month of Elul that calls upon us to leave the world of cold intellect, leave the world of words, and enter a world of visual images, a world of pictures, a world of concepts. And as we work these things through, by creating the time and creating the context in which we can actually say to ourselves, okay, now I am standing before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before the Kisei HaKavod, and I hear him asking this question. I feel the question. There's no question in my mind that if we're looking at the picture, that there will be commensurate emotions that will provoke, and that those emotions will leave us with a lasting impact of all of these majestic feelings that will enable us to then follow into the fact that when Rosh Hashanah comes about, we've done this homework well, and it's generated all kinds of feelings of excitement and wanting to better ourselves, and real feelings of regret that we have not made the greatest use of our times, real feelings of frustration with our level of ignorance, real feelings of resolve to make better use of our time, to enrich our lives. When we stand before the Almighty on Rosh Hashanah and we hear the sound of the shofar, we will hear a sound which, although it's coming out of the shofar, is really coming out of us. And that will be the vav, which will then lead us to be able to use Yom Kippur in its finest sense, to try to lend some articulation to that sound that erupts from within us, a sound that is a sound of authentic feeling, of authentic longing, and authentic regret, and the knowledge that at the end of that sound there is this tekiah gedolah, this triumphant sound that promises that we can reattach ourselves to the Almighty in ways that will enable us to reinstate ourselves, so that Yom Kippur, with its theme of atonement and forgiveness, will have a fertile ground in which to take root.